This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. On the Ground to Israel, with Jeff Halper, anthropologist and activist, coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, and author of The War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification. And Jeff, it's very good to have you back.
It's very good to be back.
Jeff, you wrote an article recently which follows the announcement by President Trump of moving the U.S. embassy to and recognizing the capital of the Jewish state, as they posit it, to be Jerusalem. Your article was, "The two-state solution only ever meant a big Israel rolling over a Palestinian Bantustan. Let it go." Why don't you first take us to your position, or how the progressive Israeli community has looked at the recent pronouncements of Trump, and indeed the visit just of Vice President Pence?
Well, you know, I mean, all these years, since 1967, pretty much, the Israeli peace camp, progressive Israelis, together with our Palestinian partners, have advocated for a two-state solution. The idea of a Palestinian state alongside the state of Israel, even though the Palestinian state would only be on 22% of historic Palestine. Nevertheless, in 1988, the PLO under Arafat accepted that solution. It's not fair and it's not just, but the Palestinians accepted it, and that's what we were working for many years. It became clear way before Trump, probably when the Oslo process collapsed almost 20 years ago, that the two-state solution was gone. As a matter of fact, when Netanyahu was elected the first time in 1996, it was clear that the two-state solution was gone and that the occupation was going to reassert itself in a very strong way. But, you know, it's very hard. It's not a scientific, you know, when did it exactly end, or what is the red line, or how do you know definitely the two-state solution is not going to be relevant anymore? That's a hard thing to call. And it's been a process of people gradually understanding that the two-state solution is gone. We understood that years ago, but for many people, it's very threatening, that idea, because especially for Jews and for most Israelis, of course, if the two-state solution is gone, it means either we have apartheid, because we have an Israel that controls the entire country, including all the land and 4.5 million Palestinians, and it can't give them citizenship, so it would be apartheid, or a binational state in which it can't be a Jewish state anymore, whatever that meant. Israelis are caught because, on the one hand, they know the two-state solution is gone, and they really don't care because the Palestinians are easy to control from the Israeli point of view. But at the same time, they can't give up the two-state solution, or at least lip service to it, because that would open the way either to apartheid or binationalism. So we're caught in a situation where we're living in an illusion. The American government, all the governments of the world, progressive Jews like J Street, for example, even progressive Israelis, the Zionist left, Meretz and the Labor Party, even the Arab List, even the Palestinian Authority, are all still talking about the two-state solution, because you avoid the crunch as long as you keep this going. And at the same time, you know, then Israel really can continue to rule, do whatever it wants to do, build settlements, control the country, without ever having to really make an agreement with the Palestinians. I think Trump's contribution to all of this, when he declared Jerusalem the capital of Israel, actually there was a very good headline in Haaretz newspaper that said Trump didn't kill the two-state solution. You know, that was killed years ago, but he buried it. Once you take Jerusalem off the table, as the way Trump puts it, you defeat the two-state solution, because there can't possibly be a two-state solution without at least a shared Jerusalem as a Palestinian capital. And besides everything else, the settlements fragment the West Bank. There is no more place for a Palestinian state. So what Trump sort of did, that's helpful, if you want to put it that way, is he cleared the air. Now I think we all have to move on from the two-state solution. The question is, where do we go? And that's where we're trying to work. A number of us, Palestinians and Israelis, are trying to really flesh out the idea of a common vision of a one democratic state solution. You know, you can't be in a political struggle without an end game. And our problem is we know the two-state solution is gone, but we, progressive Israelis and our Palestinian partners, have not suggested an alternative. So there's a vacuum here. You know, Trump and Netanyahu can do whatever they want to do because there's no pushback, because we don't have an agreed-upon progressive solution, political settlement of our own. And that's what we're working on, and we're going to have a meeting in the next couple of weeks to try to finalize that kind of a statement.
And where do you see that going, and how do you see that develop? If we accept the premise of one state solution, which again you say really means Israeli sanctioned apartheid, or as you put it in your article, eternal bloody civil war, where does that lead, and what kind of a group is actually cohering around the, what would it be, the overthrow of the conceptual framework, which seems enormously difficult, of quote-unquote a Jewish state? I mean, how do you see that unfolding?
It's going to be difficult, although we all did it with apartheid South Africa. That was unthinkable in its day as well, that apartheid would end. So there's two things, first of all, that are important to understand. One is that there already exists one state here. This whole idea of should there be two states or one state is a done deal. Between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, the entire country of Israel, Palestine, the occupied territories, is all today one functional state. There's only one government, the Israeli government, that controls everything, not the Palestinian Authority. That's really a meaningless kind of a thing. There's only one army, obviously, in the whole country. There's only one set of borders. There's only one currency. And in other words, by any measure, there already is one country, but it's an apartheid country. First of all, we have to say there is already one state, but it's in an unacceptable form, and that is apartheid. The other thing we have to say is that this is Israel's doing. We can't blame the Palestinians for this. Israel knew what it was doing over the last half century. Deliberately and systematically, Israel eliminated the two-state solution by building settlements, by annexing good parts of the West Bank, and really by almost formally not negotiating any kind of a political solution. So if there's one state today, which means then there cannot be a Jewish state called Israel, it's Israel's doing. And that's something that I think we have to really emphasize. You can't control the entire country and control all the Palestinians and still want a Jewish state. It just doesn't work. So you have apartheid. So then the question becomes a little less difficult. If there already is one state here, an apartheid regime, then the task in front of us is, how do we transform that single state that already exists into a democratic state of equal rights for all its citizens? Which should not be such a revolutionary kind of an idea for Americans. All right, well, here's some Palestinians that are saying, all right, we'll buy some of your freedom and democracy. What are you going to say, no? So that I think you can put Israel in a really an untenable position by calling it on its apartheid, but in a positive way by suggesting a way out. And that way out is, let's have one state here, what we really have already, a binational state that protects the collective rights and identities of both peoples. You know, you can still be an Israeli, you can still speak Hebrew, you can still have a Hebrew university, but you're doing that alongside Palestinians that have their identity, but sharing one common democratic regime. There are many multicultural countries in the world. I mean, one of them is Canada next door, the Francophiles and Anglophiles. You have the UK that has the English, the Scots, the Welsh, and the Northern Irish in one democratic country. There's always tensions, of course, and nothing is perfect, and sometimes systems decide to change, like Czechoslovakia, for example. That's legitimate. But right now, it seems to me that we've got to find a way to have these two peoples live together in one democratic country. Otherwise, we have a new apartheid regime in the world, and I would hope that not only for progressives, but for everybody, including the mainstream Jewish community, apartheid would be unacceptable. The idea that Jews become Afrikaners is a pretty chilling prospect, I think.
But you still have a colonialist state. You still have reactionary Zionism and expansionist philosophy. How do you begin that process of taking apart, which is a calcified positioning, expansionist, colonialist, inherently xenophobic and racist, therefore? Is that any more real towards the recognition of finally of Palestinians' rights as is equal in, of course, the territory that was that they have been dispossessed of?
Well, if you look at South Africa, they were three players as well. They were the black Africans, the majority. They were the white, especially the Afrikaners, but the white population that ruled in a neo-colonial situation, and the international community. And the strategy of the ANC was to, I mean, they had obviously the support of the black community, was to mobilize the international community, trade unions, intellectuals, churches, human rights organizations, the UN, governments, getting to all these international players and simply making apartheid unsustainable, forcing the white minority to give up apartheid. I mean, the whites would not have given up apartheid proactively unless they had been forced to do so. What made that possible was already in 1955. Now, we're only talking about 7 years after the start of apartheid in 1948. In 1955, the ANC already had its freedom charter that said our vision of a new South Africa is inclusive of everyone. Now, they all didn't agree on that. Winnie Mandela didn't agree. Steve Biko didn't agree. You had people that said, no, this is a neo-colonial regime or a colonial regime, and South Africa should go back to the black people when we end apartheid. But the ANC said that would be too disruptive of South Africa, and they bit that bullet. And I think that this is where we are here. I think we can mobilized. A lot of the international community is mobilized. Look at the BDS movement, for example. Jewish Voice for Peace and other organizations that are very progressive. I think the young Jewish generation has really turned off from Israel and is ready to move, but they have no direction. So that if we can mobilize the already mobilized, but give them a direction, political end game, which is one democratic state, I think we can mobilize the Palestinians around that, of course, and the international community, and then to basically, you know, the Israeli Jewish population is not going to be proactive. They're not going to cooperate with this, but you simply make it unsustainable. You know, it's a small country, and by providing a just solution, which a democratic state is, by providing for the security of Israelis, ironically, which is what you do if you recognize the collective rights of Israelis. And by presenting a positive, inclusive vision of where we're going together, I think you can create a situation where people will say in the world, yes, this is a way out. That's actually good for Israelis as well. It's going to be a very difficult sell. But I think in a way you have justice, you have a good political vision. And again, if it's framed the right way, and that is that it's Israel that has created this apartheid situation. So Israel has to be held accountable for what it's doing. You put all that together, I think you could create a fairly an effective campaign that could succeed.
Do you have partners in this effort? Right. Is the boycott, divestment, sanction movement on the ground there in support? Where does the Palestinian Authority? Where do the Palestinian partners come into this strategy and concern, Jeff?
Well, the Palestinians, especially the PLO, had a one-state solution since its beginning. already in the 1960s, in 64, the Palestinian Liberation Organization was founded during all the years until 1988, when it actually adopted a two-state solution. It had a one-state solution as its program. So this is nothing new for Palestinians. Even their concept, and it's not a trick or anything, but they were very upfront about it. They said, we agree to a two-state solution, but we Palestinians see that as a stepping stone towards one state eventually. Once we get to know each other and trust each other and start to live together, we don't see the two-state solution as the end game, but rather as a stage towards one democratic state. So that's always been their program. Now, the Palestinian Authority does not accept that, and not in principle, but I think practically. You see, this is the problem with the Palestinians, I'll be honest. And it's a problem of our organization as well, to help trying to organize. And that is that a lot of the Palestinians today in the occupied territory know that the two-state solution is gone. They accept the idea of a one-state solution, but they feel that it's impossible. Start all over again, and we've got to buck the United States and the international system, and Israel won't be a Jewish country, and that's a non-starter. So they're really very depressed and down and despondent, and in a sense, in a very apolitical moment. The BDS campaign, I have to say, which is a very important campaign because it's kept this whole issue alive, does not advocate for any particular solution. That I think is a weakness of the BDS campaign. What are we BDSing for? So I'm hoping that as we begin to articulate a joint vision, the BDS people will come on board, even though that might split the movement. But the point is, BDS is a tool. It's not a standalone movement. So where we are today is that we have a small group, an influential group of intellectuals and activists. You know, half or a little bit more than half are Palestinians. And I could give you names, but they're not names that are known outside of Palestine very much. Although there's some very important people, some activists, some professors, intellectuals, and so on. And then there's a number of Israelis as well. I mean, one of the Israelis is Ilan Pape, who's well known. Mm-hmm. Eitan Bronstein, who was the founder of Zuchrot, who's fairly well known. But again, we're local people more. We're not necessarily international stars. But within our communities, I think we have quite a bit of say. And so what we're doing is we're going to have a meeting in the UK at Ilan Pape Center in Exeter. And we formulated a kind of a draft, a document of what we how we see the one state solution, the basic principles of a one state solution, and a strategy. And we're going to get more people together in Exeter and try to come out with a joint document. And if we can do that, then we will begin to go out and try to build a movement around it. And I really think we have a chance to do that because I think, they know the two-state solution's gone. Everybody knows. It's like Leonard Cohen's song. Everybody knows. Everybody knows, And if we can fill that vacuum with a positive, constructive, but really just alternative solution coming from the people themselves, and I think we can get a good number of Israelis involved, plus our Palestinian partners. That, I think, will help mobilize the international community. So it's a small movement now, but I think the moment is ripe. It's in the air, the one state. Even the New York Times had an article a couple of weeks ago about the one state solution being in the air. So I think we just have to flesh it out and come up with a joint vision, and then I think it'll have its own impact.
The question of Israel in the international community, and now with a formidable, aggressive partner from the most conservative perspective, who, among other things, sees Israel as a bulwark against Iran and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that become a serious impediment in terms of your conceptual framework, your efforts? There's certainly the Arab states have not been empathetic in any significant way. They've really deserted for decades the Palestinian cause. How do you look at that question of the prominence of and strategic backing of Israel towards impeding the accomplishment of setting up, again, an egalitarian one state.
That was really what my book was about, my last book, War Against the People.
And I gave you that as a deliberate segue into War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification, one of the really important books that you need to read this year.
You know, I asked the question that was has been on my mind for years as an activist. How does Israel get away with this? The occupation is not popular in the world. You know, you can photograph it. There's very brutal visual images. It goes, you know, not only, you know, goes against the whole idea of human rights and international law, but even colonialism. I mean, this whole time has passed 50, 60, 70 years ago. And yet Israel gets stronger and stronger in the international community. One of the major reasons that we haven't really focused on much that I do in my book is what I call Israel's security politics. And the Ministry of Defense in Israel has a policy it calls niche filling. In other words, it surveys the entire world, where Israel is the number two or three largest arms supplier to China and to India. So it surveys those powerful countries down to every little country and warlords. You know, warlords in the Congo, for example, that control precious minerals. I mean, there are also people that have a lot of clout, and Israel has ties with them, with militias in South Sudan, for example, with militias in Colombia and other Latin American countries. And it's not only military niche filling for Israel, but it has to do with security and policing. So we all know that the Ferguson police were and the Missouri police and the St. Louis County police were trained partly by Israel. Israel has trained about 10,000 American policemen over the years, and there's very big programs, I won't get into that now, for training the American police. So that Israel, you know, is military security, surveillance, policing across the board, from the most powerful country in the world down to the most powerful warlord in his particular district in somewhere. Israel delivers. It's a nuclear power that's never signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, has one of the largest and most sophisticated armies in the world, so it can fight conventional wars. But it's very good at what's called wars against the people, which is the kind of warfare that's being fought today. Wars in Afghanistan, Somalia, you know, throughout Africa and Latin America and so on. There's dozens of wars against the people that are also, again, police wars. Wars against the black people in the United States. Wars against immigrants. Wars against crime that also get into social issues as well and class issues. So I can go country by country, literally, and show you exactly how Israel contributes, in quotes, to the security of that of the elites of those countries, the governments and the business elites and the military elites of those countries. And that's what explains, for example, Israel's love affair with Saudi Arabia today, or with Egypt, or with the Gulf states, or with China and India and Brazil. In other words, the BRICS countries that are supposed to be this counter hegemonic bloc against Euro-America are completely being supplied by Israel and are becoming very pro-Israel in international forums. When you put arms and security and policing into the political equation, it creates strange bedfellows. And then what I do in my book, because it's even a bigger story, and that is global capitalism. Because as capitalism goes more and more into crisis, and it's unsustainable, and you have the income disparities we have, and more people are being excluded, not only people in the third world, as it's called, but middle-class kids in the United States, the whole Occupy movement. As this continues, capitalism has to become more coercive. And this is precisely wars against the people. Wars today aren't wars against armies. They're wars against people that are being excluded from the system and that don't voluntarily agree to be excluded, and they resist. And that's one reason, of course, why resistance is called terrorism. You know, it all kind of fits together. But Israel is really on top of that. I would say that Israel is probably the leading thinker, if you can think of a country as a thinker, in terms of being on the cutting edge with the language, with the framing, with the concerns, the fears, what's happening in the world, the migration patterns, the scarce resources that are being competed for, the need for capital flow to go into the global north, you know, the need for more security against people that are being excluded. All of these things Israel reads very well and has an appropriate type of military technology, what I call the technology of repression, to answer whatever particular security threat the elites have in any particular country. So that begins to explain the support that Israel gets. You know, because, again, you know, you can criticize Israel, but nobody's going to sanction Israel. And that's because Israel's part of the old boys network, where Israel will help you, the elites of your country and the global elites, to stay in power. Hmm. That's what I try to document in my book. So in some ways, the Palestinians become irrelevant. And that's, I think, part of Israel's message, is that, look, we can make a separate peace with the Arab world. We can play a useful role like this in the international community without ending the occupation, without the Palestinians.
Well, we will reconnect with Jeff after the extremely important meeting that's going to be taking place at Exeter in London, and want to again encourage people to take up the reading of War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification. We have been speaking with Jeff Halper, who is the head of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and working towards building an egalitarian landmass with all of the rights for those people who have been on the land and those who have occupied it for generations and continue to be disenfranchised. Jeff Halper, thank you for spending the time with us.
And I look forward to reporting back.
Good. We look forward to hearing that. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.